Hey everybody, welcome back to We Are Movies. As always, I'm Johnny Mockney. My guest today is Jordan, one of the funniest people I know, one of my co-hosts at the Weekly Crunch at Crunchies. Fairly new to the Michigan comedy scene, came here from Seattle, and just an incredibly welcome presence here. Fit right into the Lansing scene especially, and has just been going all over the state and killing it, and incredibly funny. Can't recommend his comedy enough. He joined me today to talk about Flubber, the classic Disney Robin Williams film, a remake of The Absent-Minded Professor, as you'll hear us get into. We kind of talk about all aspects of this movie, everything there is to say about it from a 20-something-year-old's point of view, as well as some things surrounding it, some cultural aspects of the movie. And if you know Jordan, you know that he's, as funny as he is, he's an equally thoughtful guy as well, and really willing to delve into sort of the social contexts of every piece of art. And so we had a lot of fun talking about that. So if you've been looking for the great Flubber discussion, the buck stops here. This is it. So without any further ado, please enjoy this very flubberous episode of We Are Movies. All right, and we're off.
Yeah.
Are you turning your phone off?
I turned it on silent.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah. Just in case it rings, and then, you know, what if I'm in the middle of like a great bit? What if we're riffing so hard?
Yeah, they just break the momentum.
Yeah, being heckled
by your phone.
Yeah, I ruined one of my greatest riffs with my phone, dude.
Do you get a lot of Sunday phone calls?
Yeah, I get Sunday phone calls.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You have a real job. I forgot.
No, that's not my work phone. I didn't even bring my work phone.
Oh,
I have
okay.
Two cell phones. I have a work phone and I have a personal phone.
You just get personal calls.
People call me from my church or whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
They'll call me and they'll talk about stuff.
Okay.
Cool. Yep.
We talked about doing this for a while. Originally, we were going to do all the Twilight movies.
All the Twilight movies.
And I kept saying, like, I'm going to start watching them soon. Don't worry. And I was, like, sweating.
I'm going to watch them. Those movies are great, though.
Yeah. What's your story with those movies?
I'm from the area.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where I'm from. So, like, it was, like, you know, because I'm from, like, a small logging town in the middle of the Pacific Northwest or whatever. It's mentioned a couple times in the Twilight movies. It's not, like, Forks, but...
Is that where it's filmed?
Yeah, it's filmed in Forks, and it's filmed in New Zealand. Like, a lot of movies are filmed in New Zealand and whatnot. And so, I mean, we'll start and we'll talk about Twilight, because I have some stuff to say. But it was cool, because, like when I was reading the books, it's like, oh, this is, like, you know, where I'm from, you know what I'm saying, or whatever. And the movies came out, and then the whole area kind of became a tourist attraction for, like, teenage girls when I was going through puberty. So it turned, like, this town of, like, 1,000 people that are all, you know, the women are all scarred by the logging industry or whatever. into a teenage paradise. And now I'm, like, out of boners, I think. I used all of them.
All these girls have never touched a log in their life.
Suddenly they're attracted to, like, pale kids who wear cardigans, you know. I'm like, oh, finally.
it's our time.
Thank God.
Yeah, so you're saying Twilight's important to you because it opened up so much sexual real estate.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't move in on anything. You know, the market cap is way too high. it's really like big equity came in, you know, just really pushed all the little guys out. There's no retail crowd of pussy. You know, it's big pussy.
So you were in big pussy. So I got to stand up for the little guy.
I really hope there's a deflationary phenomenon.
I don't think we're 2 minutes in. We already probably hit the high point.
I asked if kids were going to listen right before. And you're like, no. And I was like, all right, good. No,
I don't believe kids listen. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not.
Your mom does, though.
My mom does. My mom can take it.
Yeah, I've been following her on Instagram. I look at all her, like, her dishes that she makes or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
dude. I mean, I have... There are... So, my Instagram, there is a very non-significant portion of it that is just moms that like cook, right? And they're all from, like, your mom's from Thailand, A bunch of the people I follow are Filipino people's moms because there's so many Filipino people in the Navy or whatever. And then all their moms cook and they're all like so good or whatever. So yeah, like yours is Sopa Cooks, but I always confuse her with my friend's mom who's Sobe's Kitchen.
That's an understandable mistake. Yeah.
Too close. Yeah, but Sobe's Kitchen has taught me. I mean, she taught me how to make lumpia. She taught me how to make like all these things.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I mean, I love it. I love the Food Network side of like Instagram. That's a big part of my Instagram feed.
That's good. I'm glad my mom found like a thing. Like it's not just her Instagram. It's like it's specifically she went in on cooking.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Even when she's like sharing family memories, the foreground was whatever she made for us. Like
exactly, exactly. Day, you know? Yeah. I mean, so it's always like cooking and like travel.
Yeah,
there's like a few. That's
just,
I mean,
Anthony Bourdain lifestyle.
Yeah. That's the run through. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you're not you're not really a movie guy. You said this before, right?
No,
you're
not
more of a literature guy.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I wouldn't even call myself a literature guy. I mean, I like them, but. I don't know if I'm trying to be like, if I'm trying to impress somebody, I'd probably say I'm a literature guy.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I read more books than I did movies because like my parents were like really strict about the PG-13. Mm. There wasn't anything magically that transformed my life at 13, except now I was allowed to watch Bruce Almighty. Sure. And I remember I really wanted to watch Bruce Almighty growing up, but I
was like controversial. This is a pretty religious family, right?
I don't know. Not like super. I don't even think it was tied to any kind of like religious thing just necessarily. Yeah. I think they just saw it and they were like, all right, well, 13, you know, if the Motion Picture Association of America says it, well, who are we to disagree? Right. I saw way worse stuff than Bruce Almighty leading up to 13, you know, like in real life, just around, you know what I'm saying? So
by the time you're 13.
By the time I'm 13, it really didn't. But I think it was the fact that it was forbidden that like, you know, that kind of concept, like denial creates desire or whatever. And then finally when your desire is realized, then it's like, it's just empty. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Because I built it up in my head, you know what I'm saying? Like Bruce Almighty's like, oh, he's God, what's he going to do? And then all he does is like he moves the moon so he could get laid a little bit.
But then I love that.
Probably raise the sea level like 500.
They briefly show on TV that there was like a flood in some other country because of mysterious solar, like, or mysterious lunar, you know, activity. People are dead because he was so horny. Anyway, that's the point of Bruce Almighty.
No, and this is a great tie-in to Flubber. Because I feel we haven't talked about Flubber yet. That's what we were going
to
talk about.
Let's get into Flubber.
So, like, it's weird, right? Because both, I think, like, you have, like, Flubber. He's, like, Robin Williams is playing, like, this scientist, like, Dr. Brain Nerd or whatever. And
I never thought of it as Brain Nerd.
Yeah, Brain Nerd. That's a Brain Nerd. And he's, you know, I mean, he's a great scientist. You know, he's building robots, artificial intelligence, perpetual motion machines, all that good stuff. And same with, like, you know, Jim Carrey and Bruce Almighty and a lot of, like, these comedy stars or whatever. It's like, oh, man, they're brilliant or they're all powerful or they're super talented, but women just can't figure them out.
Well, and it's like he fails at basic things in life that we totally understand. Like, we would remember when our wedding's going to be.
He goes three weddings.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I get that because he already has a pancake robot. Why is he getting
married?
Why is she getting married? She's in charge of a multi-million-dollar endowment at an Ivy League school. Neither of these people should be married.
Yeah, why is Marsha Gay Harden going to marry the professor nerd?
Neither of them, they're fine on their own.
It's
literally just society, the film industry forcing them to be together.
I would even argue the conclusion of the film still says that.
Yeah.
You know, which we'll get to. But I want to briefly say, like, did you come into Flubber in a notable way, or were you just little and
it was just like one of the movies that we had, so I watched it a lot.
Okay.
You know, because, and I mean, like, slapstick, I love slapstick comedy.
Oh yeah.
I think it's great. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Do you have a history of being a Robin Williams fan at all, or not especially, like, not more than others?
No, I don't think more than others. I think I've watched most of them.
Yeah.
The one where he kills the clown? You ever seen that one?
No, what's that one?
Oh, you haven't seen that movie? It's one of the other worst Robin Williams movies, if you look them up. But so it's a movie about how he's like a children's TV clown or whatever. But then some other like guy who dresses as a dinosaur. It's a very dark. It's a darker movie and whatnot. It's like Get Stuffy or Get Sprinkles or whatever. And then he murders the other guy.
Is it a comedy?
Not really. Okay. It kind of is. It's kind of funny, the situation, but it's not played expressly for laughs like his other kind of like Robin Williams.
It's like that one that Kevin Smith produced movie. There was like a dark
World's Greatest Dad.
Well, no, that's I was gonna say dark one. World's Greatest Dad is great. Yeah, I think Robin Williams is fantastic in that movie. No, there's a Kevin Smith movie that's like a horror movie about a clown that's stupid, but but yeah, no, World's Greatest Dad. He's great in dark roles. 1 Hour Photo is another really amazing one. Christopher Nolan's Insomnia also. But yeah, I mean, this is classic, like, silly Robin Williams. Late 90s Robin Williams was all this.
Yeah, he was a silly guy.
Late 90s Robin Williams kind of coincides with late 90s Eddie Murphy a little bit. He was doing, like, Dr. Dolittle at the time. Mm-hmm. So they'd kind of moved away from, you know, this kind of, like, coked up, kind of edgy stand-up comic to...
100%.
Now we're the Family Guy doing slapstick. But I was... I knew of Flubber. I had seen so many. Like, I 100% knew it's Robin Williams and it's this little green goo that dances or something.
Yep.
And that's pretty much all I knew. And I had definitely seen parts on Disney Channel or whatever.
Yeah.
But this was my first time yesterday sitting down watching. It was first time seeing it all the way through. And it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I was surprised at how little of a character Flubber was. I think I expected it was more of like a buddy movie about Robin Williams and Flubber.
Yeah.
But Flubber is much more of a plot device than a character.
Than an actual thing. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's a Disney movie. You know, so all it has to be is kind of like cute and whatnot. But it's also a remake of The Absent-Minded Professor. So it's a remake of a different movie, and there's a lot of stuff that's different about The Absent-Minded Professor than there is about Flubber. The basic premise is the same, and The Absent-Minded Professor is actually way more of a... It's almost like an educational film of how much science they actually, like, put into it. You know what I'm saying? Because they actually kind of show, like, how he discovers it, even though it's in, like, a weird way, because the... it's going to sound so stupid, I can't believe I'm saying this, but the physics of Flubber, right, is he finds... He creates a substance where, basically... like entropy or whatever, the second law of thermodynamics, right? If work is done, right, he will be expelled. You rub your hands together, it gets hot. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So instead of that, he reverses, when he's doing the math, he like reverses a sign, right? So now the entropy of the system, right, if work is done on a system, it'll take heat from the surrounding system and convert it into more work.
Yeah.
Right, which would explain, so a lot of people, I was even like reading reviews or whatever, and there's that scene with like the bowling ball where it hits the guy like on the face, you know, and it bounces up into the air, right? And they're like, no, it would totally kill that guy. And it's like, no, it wouldn't. It was coated in flubber. So what it did was, when it hit him, it took energy from his face in the form of heat and the natural air, and then used it to propel itself. So you wouldn't even feel anything. You would just get really cold.
Right, right. So this movie kind of doesn't. It kind of tries to have it both ways, where he survives it, but also it still hurts.
It's the It is weird.
The bowling ball to the head. Well, that's clearly. I was watching that and I was thinking, because also it's written by John Hughes.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the bricks to the face scene from Home Alone 2.
Yeah.
Lost in New York, because there's a Harry and Marv esque pair of guys in this movie.
Smith and Wesson.
It's the two henchmen for our rich mustache twirling villain, played by Ted Levine, who is Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs.
Yep.
And Clancy Brown, who was I guess now is more known for playing Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob.
Yeah, he's the voice.
But I was also, he was like the Kraglin in Highlander and stuff like that.
He's in the Shawshank Redemption too, right?
He's in Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, he's the guard. Yeah. He's the sergeant.
Kind of like both accomplished character actors, both just doing pratfalls pretty much in the movie.
He's in the Dexter remake too. You ever watch that?
The
newest season,
No, I haven't.
Yeah, he's like the serial killer. Because there has to be another season.
He's great. He's a great villain.
Yeah, he is.
He showed up in like a Promising Young Woman, and he's just like a kind dad in that movie. And I was like,
That guy's a thug.
I think it's kind of the shtick of that movie, but yeah, it's kind of interesting to see him play that part. But
Will Wheaton's a bratty rich kid.
Will Wheaton's the bratty rich kid. So yeah, all-star supporting cast here. Marsha Gay Harden, obviously, is the love interest.
She's just on Law and Order, right? Or some shit?
She was also... I knew her from The Mist. She was in The Mist. She's kind of the crazy religious lady. And then she's also in Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers movie. I knew her from that.
I haven't seen that one.
But also, famously, like, the 90s... smarmy guy, Christopher McDonald.
Yeah,
dude. Like, playing the same role in every movie. I loved his first scene. You know, when he shows up.
I'm going to steal this from you.
No,
and your fiance.
His very first scene is him just stating his entire motivation, everything that's wrong with him. I wrote it down. He walks in because he just walks in on, you know, Robin Williams is doing experiments. He's supposed to get married that night, but inevitably he's going to forget about it. And he just walks in and he says like, all right, I'll admit, I'm petty, corrupt, I've profited from your ideas. And then Robin Williams is like, well, why are you here? And he goes, I'm here to steal your fiance and make her my wife. That is efficient writing. So he's great. I think Christopher McDonald's like an effortlessly like kind of watchable presence. And at the core of this movie, the reason I think I was really into it and then kind of fell off the last 20 minutes or so is I think the heart of this movie is Robin Williams using this amazing scientific experiment to try to prevent himself from getting cucked by Shooter McGavin.
That's what he is. Yeah, he literally invents a perpetual motion machine, and he's not, like, he's invented a sentient AI pancake robot, which has appeared in 8 other movies. That exact robot is like huge. Yeah, it's in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. It's in about the exact same robot. That pancake robot's famous. He has all these things. He has the trash can rocket that shoots a rocket. Like, there's no reason that he needs this relationship.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure if you did like a prequel movie, it's just him just trying to like not get fired is the only reason that he's dating his boss.
That's probably it.
He probably just
doesn't. He's dating the dean for that only reason.
He just doesn't want to lose tenure, and she doesn't want to lose him because he's just grant money flowing in.
That's one thing I was thinking is like, you know, he misses out on the wedding and she's mad at him, and he shows up the next day and he's like, yeah, I'm sorry I missed the wedding, but I got this, I got flubber, and it's an amazing thing that he's holding in his hand. If I saw it, I'd be like, what the hell is that? And she's just like, oh, you know, she's still mad about the wedding. She's like, oh, that's great. And then he's like, no, this is what's going to save the college. And she's like, oh, whatever.
She doesn't care about
it. And then it's not until the end of the movie where his robot comes and helps him out, wingmans him, and she comes back to him and loves him again. Then he shows her flubber again, and she's like, wow, this could save the college. And he's like, yeah, that's what I said, but you're too mad about the wedding. Like, the emotional woman that you are. Like, I don't want to, you know, obviously she has all the rights to be, she has every right to be mad about the wedding, but I think I'd still be surprised by flubber.
Yeah.
Regardless. Well,
and I mean, like, this, it's so weird that the idea of her as a woman, just, I've never met anyone like that. Her character's so bizarre. Like, it's not written in any sort of consistency, and I think that's because... If you look at, like, the absent-minded professor, they took some elements of that relationship and put it into the context of this new relationship. So, in the absent-minded professor, she's just some woman who can't apply for a credit card or any of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's really, like, that older idea of what a woman should be or whatever. And then they just took that character and then they plopped her into the dean of an Ivy League college and didn't really change anything about it. So she's still trying to play this kind of like naivete. This is the, you know, I am here for your emotional support, this, that, the other, this role. But she doesn't, they don't mature her in any other sort of way. You know what I'm saying?
It's strange because I think her first scene establishes her to be a character that she's not. When we first meet her, we see her in her office standing on her desk, getting her, like, fitted for her, you know, wedding dress. But she's on the phone dealing with stuff.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, she's, like, serious business. She's a workaholic. Like, you know, oh, like, she's just getting, like, the dress is getting fitted, but her mind's not really on that right now. Yeah, but then it's not the character that she is at all.
It isn't, yeah.
She's much more of, like, a typical love interest character.
Yeah, basically. And then, I mean, the part that freaks me out every time is that she is, you know, she's a multimillionaire. She's making at least 800, 900 grand a year, right? Mm-hmm. And then the shot of her in her child, in like the bedroom, it's like the bedroom of a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's the size of this little kitchenette.
Right.
She's got a headboard, like the all white headboard.
It's not the master bedroom.
Basically a crib. Yeah, she's still living with her parents, probably.
And then
Robin Williams, who invented a sentient robot, is the one that brings them back together.
Yeah.
It's the sentient AI.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the visual language of the movie where it's like the opening scene reminded me a lot of the beginning of Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of panning around his apartment and you're kind of seeing what kind of guy he is and all the contraptions he has.
Yeah.
Very similar to the setup of Doc Brown. And then also this movie's shot by Dean Cundey, who's actually my favorite cinematographer of all time.
Oh, really?
He shot the majority of John Carpenter's movies, like Halloween, Escape from New York, The Thing. He also shot Back to the Future, funny enough.
Really?
And then he did some of Spielberg's movies, like Jurassic Park. And then now has this insane career where he does stuff like he did Jack and Jill with Adam Sandler. Like, doesn't even like I think he just turns lights on pretty much now. For a long time was like that, you know. His sort of the master of like the deep focus and the wide lens. And obviously this movie's not like, you know, I don't think I walk away from Flubber going like, oh, the cinematography.
No, yeah.
But the movie does a couple tricks where I genuinely think in some cases the effects in this movie are better than effects in movies I see today. Like, there's like, I think his flying, what is it, Weebo is the robot?
Yeah, Weebo is the robot. Voiced by Jody something.
I don't know who plays Weebo.
She does I can tell you what. She does the voice of the Little Mermaid. She does the voice of Barbie in the Toy Story movies, and then she does this, which means that she holds the Jeopardy category of things that I want to have sex with that don't have a vagina.
Jodie Benson. Yeah, Jodie Benson. Yeah, I think she's great. Like, it's a vocal performance. She's very
good. 100%.
I love at the very beginning where she's like, she's intentionally not showing him that he's supposed to get married that day, and she's like, oh, I know. I wish there's something I could do. And, but also as an effect, I was really spending a lot of time like, how are they doing this? Because it's like, I'm assuming it's an optical, you know, seamlessly done. There's a little part where they kind of try to show off a bit where like when he puts the flubber on the basketball and it's spinning out his finger, and they make a point of having Robin Williams turn around and having the basketball go behind his head and in front just to kind of show off a bit. And it looks seamless. Like it's not that like clear kind of one's kind of blue. Obviously like flubber looks kind of fake, but also like not more so than you would expect flubber to be. Like,
it's very lifelike, it's very animated, it's very engaging. Like everything in the movie is very engaging. And I think this is the general thesis that I have about the movie, is that it is filled with so much just raw talent.
Yeah.
But every single person just did not give a shit.
Yeah.
Like, at all. You know, like, this is them, like, when they're not even trying.
Right.
Every single person in this movie is just, sure, whatever. You know, like, I can act or shoot this or write that. You know, so they're just...
I want to talk... Yeah, no, that's really important, because I want to talk a little bit about some of the other people behind the camera here.
Yeah.
It's directed by a man named Les Mayfield. I just want to say, before I use this word, no judgments on him. You got to make a living. You know, he did what he had to do, but kind of the epitome of like a late 90s hack. His previous films before this were Encino Man and the remake of Miracle on 34th Street.
Yep.
And then right after this did Blue Streak with Martin Lawrence. So really? Like, just kind of like a for hire kind of guy, you know. But then the screenplay by the one and only John Hughes.
From Lansing, right?
I know he, he's from Chicago.
He's born in Lansing,
I think. But he might be born in Lansing, yeah. I think.
I looked up his Wikipedia.
Yeah, born in Lansing.
He's one of the famous people born in Lansing. It's like,
you're right.
Him, Magic Johnson, and Jimmy Page.
And then Steven Seagal lived here for a bit, but I don't know if he was from here. But John Hughes, I think it's fascinating that at this point in career, his career, he was just doing this, these plug-in, like, just writing a screenplay for some property that I'm not passionate about, considering that he was a very important 80s auteur, like as a writer and a director.
He's prolific.
Prolific. He like, really was, The Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller guy, Pretty in Pink. Like, and then this is where he was in the late 90s. It kind of baffles me. I wonder like if his downfall is pinpointed on one thing.
I think he just kind of gave up. He was just coasting. I really think he was just coasting. You know what I'm saying?
Like, he'd seen enough success.
Oh, yeah. He'd made millions. You know, he really, you know.
And also into the 90s, the type of movies he was making weren't in anymore. Like, I think they got, you know, they kind of transformed into whatever the 90s sort of.
Yeah, the 90s was weird.
The 90s had the kind of that auteur indie movement with, the Kevin Smiths and the Tarantinos and Spike Lee's of the world, you know.
That's true. It was this cocaine filled we're gonna defeat bullying and drugs,
right.
It's just people high-fiving.
And so I genuinely think one thing is like a lot of the dynamics that John Hughes portrayed in his movies that he was really able to find success in didn't really exist anymore.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't there to capitalize on as much. So it was like, all right, well, write Flubber. Like, it was the natural progression. And then, yeah, also around the time, still wrote, like, the Latter Day Vacation movies came out around this time. And he wrote and directed a movie called Curly Sue with Jim Belushi.
Curly Sue.
I think that was the last one that he wrote and directed. Huh. That Steve Carell's first movie.
Really?
Does not have any lines, but has a character with a name. But anyway, yeah, that's where John Hughes was, and then that's where Les Mayfield was at the time. Robin Williams, kind of similar, like I said, doing a lot of kids stuff at the time. Did a previous movie. I've done one other Robin Williams film on this podcast.
It's
with Osa, and we talked about Bicentennial Man, which is also not technically under the Disney label. It's under Touchstone, which was Disney, but for like PG-13 movies. That was their whole thing. If Disney produced a PG-13 movie, they didn't want to put the Disney label on it, so it was Touchstone. But it was during a time where he was primarily doing Disney properties. And Bicentennial Man, very, also kind of a weird, like a, have you ever seen that one?
No.
It's similar in that it's like a high concept, like Flubber is, but then also it takes weird
turns. It's like someone's an android or something.
Yeah,
or
he's like a robot. He's a robot. But he's like slowly discovering his humanity.
But he can like feel,
yeah, which is an element of this. Like you said, you think Spike Jonze got the inspiration for her from,
exactly. from Flubber. From the subplot of Flubber, where Weebo, it even has the same, where she's trying to like make a hologram that'll have sex with him.
Yeah.
Right, it has the exact same feel as when her implants her, you know, like voice and everything on just that one, you know, like prostitute or whatever. And he's like, "This is weird," you know. Like, Robin Williams does the same. Like, "No, this is weird again."
Yeah.
I still want you to be there in the marriage. I want you to, you know, what I'm saying. I guarantee you that Weebo's, you know, played porn for him or something. Oh, yeah, probably, you know. Yeah. So she probably offended. Like, oh, sorry.
They have a complicated history, probably.
No holograms. That's where you draw the line. You're not a hologram guy.
Yeah, and Weebo has a tragic demise as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Not expect this to be like a murder revenge climax.
Exactly, dude. Yeah, they murk her.
I do think out of all of this is thrown around a lot as kind of a just like a gimmick, people can be goofy. Genuinely, I think an R-rated remake of Flubber could be incredible.
Oh, like, that'd be so good.
Just because like the way I think Flubber as a what it does for matter is such a fascinating thing to be able to play with, like, when Flubber's like going house to house and like going through guys' trash bags.
Yeah, it's because he's like absorbing energy with
everything. What if Flubber just went through a guy, you know? What if Flubber just went through a person's head? What if, like, that's all my brain was going to?
And maybe, I mean, it wouldn't, right? Because that...
No, he would bounce off, I guess.
Yeah, he would bounce off and get faster. He would only bounce off and get faster, and you would never feel... That's how messed up the physics of the movie are, is that you wouldn't ever be injured by it. Yeah. It's effectively... You're effectively injuring it, right? Yeah. Plus the surrounding environment, and it's absorbing all of that.
So then it kind of contradicts when he like goes through the garbage bag, or even goes through a window, because Flubber goes through a window a couple.
Yeah, times. it is kind of weird, right? Because in the original movie, it's so much less, right? Where he's just bouncing it, and it just gets slightly higher.
Yeah.
Every single time, it's a much more muted. But the like it's like the plot devices, it just takes too long.
Yeah.
For them to understand what's going on, that it's getting slightly higher every single time.
Right.
Because it's not like it could actually absorb that much heat. There's not like that much like latent, you know, heat everywhere. And that's why it doesn't work when it gets cold. Right. Mm. When Flubber gets frozen or whatever, it no longer has the, you know, property to actually absorb heat.
Right.
Or whatever from the area. So it would actually...
Yeah,
I don't know. It would be dependent on temperature, but there's so much that you have to change in it, and I'm not.
Well, you'd like have to change the fact that a Flubber is also sentient.
Yeah, it's a sentient lie. It's not sentient in the absent-minded professor. Right. It's more Flubber about how he forgets stuff.
Sneezes and has a bit of a voice sometimes, and
dances.
And famously dances. I was going to say this: the centerpiece of this film. I think the best scene in the movie is when Robin Williams goes to the basketball game, and he's bringing the basketball game, and so you get a lot of good gags in that. But in a way, in a scene that has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the story, we cut back to Weebo like getting Flubber out of the container for some reason, and then Flubber turns on a record and starts dancing to the Mambo
Del Flubber.
Yeah,
the track's called by Danny Elfman.
Great Danny Elfman.
Also, somebody who's just a banger, a titan of the film industry,
yeah,
doesn't give a shit in this movie at all.
No, I did not hear. I did not hear the Mambo in this movie and go like, "Oh, that's Danny Elfman." I've never heard it. No. All right, but in this, this is the epitome of a scene where producers were like, "You gotta have him dance, you know? Like he's gonna dance, right? Like if this movie was made, that's what Danny meant. If this movie was made in 2012, he would rap. That's." That's like, it's whatever the gimmick is at that time. You have to have your goofy little character do this thing. Yep. And I'm willing to believe that Flubber, the reason they made that important change from the absent-minded professor to make Flubber a sentient character is purely so they could have a dance scene. Where Flubber inexplicably splits into many Flubbers, dances with himself.
Dude, the dances.
Or their self. I don't know. It's like,
you know, a gender Flubber.
Gender Flubber. I don't think they ever
I honestly think if you gender him as a woman, women would be offended because it's a slob. He's just like such a slobby dude. No,
that's a man if I've ever seen just a slob. Just wrecking everything.
But I mean, I don't know. I mean, he double genders himself, you know what I'm saying? Because he makes the one with the skirt.
He does.
You know what I'm saying?
No, if anything, that's the case for sort of gender fluidity.
That's he's a gender fluid. He's a gendered fluid.
That's I'm sure there's some queer readings of Flubber out there.
I love how he growls. That's my favorite part of it. It's like how he gets mad at the villain.
Yeah.
He's liquidy growl.
Flubber has morality. Flubber knows who's good and bad.
It's kind of...
Well, I was going to say that brings me to another way I think this could be a fun R-rated movie is the natural progression of Flubber is at the end of the movie he's got to go inside of a person. Somebody's got to swallow. You know, it's bound to happen. And it's a very satisfying moment when he goes directly into Christopher McDonald's mouth and then Christopher McDonald shits him and then passes out. And or dies.
Yeah, 100%.
It's sort of, you don't really know if he died or if he just passed out.
I feel like his insides would freeze. That's what I think. That's what I think should happen, is everything that comes in contact with Flubber should have its temperature reduced so far that...
That could be good.
I mean, if he's moving at that kind of speed, you'd have to absorb so much heat. And I'm not like a thermodynamics expert. I worked in nuclear power, so I have some idea of heat transfer, right? But not to the extent. But yeah, if you reverse it, it's got to be...
Yeah.
Gotta be. It's not supposed to be. I don't know. That's whatever. Yeah, yeah.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Allison.
We've both been guests on We Are Movies before.
We love talking movies with Johnny.
But I'm a jealous boy.
You are. That's why we've decided to talk movies with each other.
We started our own podcast called
You Made Me Watch. Each week we make each other watch a movie the other has never seen.
You Made Me Watch.
New episodes every Friday.
No, but I also want to say this about Christopher McDonald. It's you can tell that he's a top tier slapstick actor because you watch what's the guy's name who's in Silence of the Lambs? Ted Levine. Ted Levine gets hit by a bowling ball, right? Mm. And he does a good job, right? He flips onto his back or whatnot. Christopher McDonald gets hit with an apple.
And he does his eyeballs roll up.
He flips off his head. He flips onto his back, even though the apple hit him on the top of the head.
Right.
He's just. I like that. He's so committed to getting injured. Or maybe he had a stuntman, but I don't want to believe that.
Well, in that moment, there's like a. You think. Well, Christopher McDonald at this point had done this character so many times. He was already Shooter McGavin and Happy Gilmore. He was already in Dirty Work.
Yeah.
You know, already made a living off of playing this guy. Robin Williams, because that's the scene where the first scene where Robin Williams is watching Chris McDonald try to cuck him by hanging out with Marcia Gay Harden on her porch, right? And you think that he's gonna pull some kind of elaborate thing to make Christopher McDonald do a shtick or a pratfall, but just takes an apple and goes like Sir Isaac and then drops it, you know, it was an Isaac Newton reference to knock him out. It's kind of, it's so lo-fi for what we'd expect from Brain Nerd.
He builds a flying car and he uses it to throw apples.
He uses it to throw apples on people's heads. They don't even set up the apple. It's not even Chekhov's apple, I don't think.
It's not Chekhov's apple.
Turns out to have an apple with
it. It's Chekhov's basketball game.
Chekhov's basketball game.
That's the most set up thing.
I was going to say a fun, good line from Weebo is when he accidentally puts Weebo under the hood of the car. And Weebo was trying to get out. And he opens it up. He's like, "What, Weebo, what were you doing in there?" And she's like, "Flirting with the alternator." It's a very just kind of quick, she's quick witted. She's a great gal, Weebo, honestly.
She is. Yeah,
he didn't realize what he had.
I know. It's so, she runs all the machines in the house, dude. She's
She's a domestic goddess.
Yeah.
She controls the pancake robot.
Dude. Yeah, yeah. What does the dean do?
She sleeps in her childhood bedroom.
Dude. Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make sense. She should date Christopher McDonald. That was the only date that she goes on.
Yeah.
Like, Christopher McDonald, of everything, is not bad to her at all. You know what I'm saying? He hasn't... Robin Williams has missed 3 weddings.
Honestly, that's one thing, is oftentimes when you have a character like this, you have him appear more... Like, we know he has bad motivations because he says them.
I am a corrupt.
So in some ways, he's a very honest guy. Like, he's not a hypocrite, you know? But then, like, in his scenes with Marcia Gay Harden, there isn't even, like, a scene where he kind of is, like, a bad guy. Like, he's a bit of a slime ball where he's not a gentleman. He's very normal with her.
He's like, not being rude. He doesn't, like, you know, like, try and invite himself in. He's just like, can I take you to a basketball game? Yeah. And if they win...
Right. You know? Well, and she even makes that offer. She's like, oh, you know, obviously I'll buy you dinner because you'll probably win. Like, she says that to him.
Oh, yeah, she does.
She's the one who's kind of making those moves on him. You know, and he's just like, okay. Like, you know, like, they're having wine on her porch and he's just, you know, she's like, I think it's time to go to bed. And he's like, all right. He's like, he's just like a kind... Just this nice guy. And Robin Williams is flying around his car throwing apples at people because he's too childish and dumb to remember his own wedding.
It is hardly a matter of stealing your fiance if, you know what I'm saying, like, she hasn't, he's missed 3 weddings.
There's nothing, he's not doing anything by force, really. He even, like, he's just there to help drive her home after Robin Williams leaves her at the altar and doesn't even say, and then she says something like, there's a moment where she's like, are you going to say I told you so? And he's like, no, I wouldn't do that. And that's it. That's all he says. He's like, I'm just going to drive you home. And there isn't that scene where, because I think about other movies where they had that scene where, like, there is a guy like that who's, like, trying to swindle and take the girl from the guy. But there's a couple moments, like, I'm thinking, like, there's something about Mary. You ever seen that?
Yeah, I
have. Where, like, Matt Dillon is, it still comes out with Mary that he's kind of a dick, but she kind of overlooks it because it's more him showing his true colors. Mm-hmm. But Christopher McDonald doesn't show his true colors really until the very end, where it's like, oh yeah, I'm working with the evil rich guy now.
Yeah,
because they needed to tie me back into the story somehow.
Which is weird, right? Because I mean, I feel like that's kind of a trend in a lot of movies. I think not anymore as much, but, like, it would be. You have to have some sort of external factor to show that this guy's a bad guy.
Yeah.
Instead of just how he
what treats he says the people. About himself.
Yeah, or some, like, broad thing that he does, and that should make him evil. And, you know what I'm saying? Because you could totally be, you know, just, like, a generally bad guy or, you know, whatever, in some area of your life, but, like, be really good to your family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, conversely, right, you could be an absolute, you know, monster to your family or whatever, and then just in broader society be very good, you know, guy. And it doesn't seem like this movie kind of wants to grasp that nuance. It just wants to attribute bad guy to this external thing and whatnot, and then say he is not deserving of love. Whereas Brain Nerd is just a terrible, like, husband, boyfriend, et cetera, et cetera, right? But, well, you know, he's working for the betterment of humanity, so, you know.
And he's going to save the college.
He should nut.
He deserves to nut.
So it's a question of, like, which guy gets to nut, huh? Right. Which guy, do you have to be a good guy to the people you're with, or do you just have to be good to broader society? We'll just let you nut with somebody who doesn't like you.
This script is the epitome of, like, telling and not showing. Like, one of the rules of scripts is always, like, show, don't tell, right? Like, nothing about Christopher McDonald's actions tells us he's a bad guy. We only know he's a bad guy because he himself says, I'm a bad guy. That's the only reason we know that. There's him and Robin Williams saying, you used to stole my ideas. And he's like, yep, that's right. Now I'm going to sue your wife. And that's it. That's, like... Like, you think that's proof that, like, John Hughes, a great screenwriter, did not give a shit with anything he put in this movie.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
like even his sillier scripts, like, I genuinely think the scripts for Home Alone 1 and 2 are pretty solid, like, in terms of structure, in terms of setups and payoffs, like, you know, he knows the rules of screenwriting, and this one just kind of felt like, here it is. Here's weird. Flubber.
Yeah. The subplot with Weebo is the best part, but aside from that.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Aside from that, he doesn't.
And I genuinely think the stuff with Robin Williams trying to stop Christopher McDonald from taking his wife, also really good. Like, I love the basketball sequence.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It just doesn't feel like a cohesive unit.
Well, and then that's where I think, where the reason it kind of falls apart in the last act is, like, you have Weebo just kind of has a change of heart, because she's been kind of the reason, the thing getting between him and Marcia Gay Harden.
Yeah.
Because she's in love with him. Mm-hmm. But then ends up... And Weebo also has this thing where she communicates with, like, clips from movies and shows.
Yeah.
Which is, I thought, was kind of reminded me...
Exclusively copyright Disney content.
Yeah.
If this wasn't a Disney movie, then the plot of the movie would about be him getting sued into the ground and buried in the
wall. They could play Disney movies. They had full access to the Disney vault here. Yeah. And, but also kind of felt like a precursor to what they do with Bumblebee and the Transformers
movies. Yeah, exactly. Where, you know, exactly. Same color, too.
This movie gave us her and Transformers. But
you prototype some of the most blockbuster franchises.
But it seems kind of strange how it's just that Weebo has a change of heart and then goes to Marcia Gay Harden and is like, hey, here's a video of him saying that he really loves you. And she's like, oh, okay. And that's all it takes.
Yeah.
It feels a little like, is that all we needed? Was just that? Like, is that enough to warrant him missing three weddings, you know?
And exactly. Then, it's taking the 1960s woman, 1960s interpretation of a woman, just plopping her in the shoes of the, you know, the leading woman in this movie.
Of an ostensibly powerful
woman. Yeah, an ostensibly powerful woman that literally has no idea what kind of leverage she can pull. Exactly.
Doesn't pull any of her leverage.
She has enough of it.
She can fire him. Like,
she can fire him.
You don't really know much
about
him.
She can at least make him feel bad. Like, that's all she does, is she just, like, makes him feel bad.
Yeah.
And that's not indicative of a relationship where there's, you know, equal power. You know, you're not going to do that. You're gonna implement some consequences. Oh, you know, you're going to... Yeah, for real.
Yeah, that would be more present in the 2020s remake if they were to do it.
100%, you know,
I think.
This idea that just my absence is what's going to hurt you is silly. That's not how you hurt somebody.
Right.
You really hurt them.
So that happens, and then that's where it kind of loses me, because then the whole plot of him trying to stop himself from getting cocked is gone, and then it's them just flying. They go to Ford. We get Ford product placement. Exactly. Where they go to Ford Industries to sell their idea because Flubber can make cars fly.
Yep. They fly up to the executive suite.
They fly up to the executive. And that was kind of... That felt like the movie was kind of going outside of the more kind of grounded, quote-unquote, story that it was, where now it's like, we're going to sell our big idea and save the college and... you know, I was kind of like, all right, this is just, we're doing this until we get to the conclusion.
Because again, that's the plot of the absent-minded professor.
Right.
But it's the U.S. government. He's trying to, like, land a defense contract.
Of course. Well, the 50s.
But the Christopher McDonald character is actually actively trying to steal his idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or ruin his reputation and whatnot. And that's kind of the central conflict. And he's already, and it's more about him being absent-minded and how his, you know, like, fiance helps him to, like, be less absent-minded, be more kind of engaged and whatnot. And then, so the central conflict is more based around his development as a character rather than kind of like the, I don't know, Robin Williams is just, like, you know, chasing a nut that shouldn't be existing. You know, like, it doesn't make sense for him to even chase that nut, man. Like, that's not...
Well, that's one thing. It's like the movie's... You kind of got to pick, what is this movie about? Is this movie about winning over your ex, or is it about saving the college? And the movie is about winning over your ex for 75% of the movie, and then the last 25% is about saving the college. So it feels a little tacked on.
Yeah, and it also feels kind of dumb, because now we know that the college is just going to raise tuition.
Right. It's all you have to do.
You didn't need to come up with
this
any
movie spelled out an alternative back in 1997, and since 1997 the price of tuition has multiplied.
What the fuck groundbreaking thing is a college come up with?
They haven't found shit. Like, what's all their research going to?
They do the Tesla? I don't think they did.
No.
I think that guy went to college, but he didn't learn how to do the Tesla. That's probably a more in-depth research process.
Probably.
Way more nuanced than fucking, but I don't know.
Have you seen The Absent-Minded Professor?
Yes.
Okay, I haven't seen it. Is there like a sort of like a Red Scare element to its...
A little bit, yeah.
...motivation in the being like defense contracting? And,
little. I mean, it's more like, it's more like post-World War kind of stuff or whatever. Yeah. So you're still kind of like dealing with the expansion of and like guaranteeing the security of the world and how we're... Because at that point, you know, we really did have this feeling like, okay, we really did save the world. We're really, you know, a global force for good.
Mm-hmm.
All that good stuff.
So that's kind of the backdrop to it. I wouldn't say it's like a central theme, sure, but you well, can yeah. kind of yeah you can
you
kind
can
of
extract start. It if you're looking at the time period and
yeah, because it's movies I guess back then weren't as big of a societal commentary in the way that we think that they are now.
Right. Well, I think it's less commentary, but more so that everything somewhat reflects the time it comes from, just because that's the time it came out of. You 100%. Know, and it not doesn't necessarily mean that the movie has a message.
Yeah,
it just means that. What its surrounding elements are always going to inform the movie.
I think it's a much more character driven movie on the part of the lead actor. I don't know his name. He's like one of those Cary Grant types or something.
Lead actor was Fred McMurray.
Fred McMurray.
It's Professor Ned Brainerd. I was going to say, well, you know, alternatively, in the 90s, everyone was just horny. That was the... That was the crux of this movie, because that was the zeitgeist.
And those are the best... those are some of the best John, you know, or whatever, like the John Hughes theme or whatever, like the Ferris Bueller trying to... Like, his nut makes sense. I get Ferris Bueller's, you know, quest to nut. I do not fundamentally understand... Robin Williams is a quest of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. It's not a central motivation for him. He should be focused on remembering stuff.
Yeah.
That would have been the cool character development if he could have, you know, found ways to, like, you know, remember stuff and maybe not rely on, you know, the robot as much. Maybe I'm reading too much of what my life is, you know what I'm saying? I wrote a lot of my phone less and whatnot. And I guess, like, technology back then was different, too. We had a much more optimistic view of... you know, technology and how screens would actually play out for us.
One thing that shocked me watching this movie is I think how understated, like, in comparison to what the movie is and what I expect from him, how understated Robin Williams' performance is. Because when you think of Robin Williams, like, I would say, like, if I'm thinking about Robin Williams at, like, full 110%, I think of something like in Good Morning Vietnam when he's on the radio. Or, you know, or like Aladdin or something like that.
Yeah,
where he's like full riffing, like everything in the kitchen sink kind of mode.
100%.
And this movie, he's fairly like, a lot of the jokes are like, the joke is, oh, he walks into the wrong lecture hall where they're doing paintings of naked people and he's lecturing and he's like, oh, I'm in the wrong hall. Like, there's not a lot of Robin Williams being crazy. Like, he has a crazy look. He's kind of got crazy hair.
Yeah.
But that's it. He's sort of you know, a pretty grounded character in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Which surprised me, considering that it's a kid's movie, you know, about Flubber.
And maybe, I mean, I don't know how much of the inside of what it looks like on, like, when you're filming the movie versus when you're outside of the movie, but maybe he had, like, a perception that, because the movie's named Flubber. It's not named the absent-minded professor like it was, right? Which was, you know, Flubber was not sentient in the absent-minded professor, right? So in maybe in Robin Williams' mind, he's like, okay, this is a kid movie. It's named Flubber. I'm not the star.
Yeah, I'm taking a backseat to
Flubber. I'm not the star. I am driving this narrative forward, right? Because I'm more sentient than Flubber is.
Yeah.
But the central story is about Flubber, right? So... maybe that's what he's doing.
Sure.
Or maybe he just doesn't give a shit.
Maybe.
Yeah, because
you know. It's like Jason Lee and Alvin and the Chipmunks, that type of, you know, I'm really just here to support whatever the effect
is. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. I'm going to look up, like, what he did around this time, too. But, I mean, as a performer, like, what do you think of when you think of Robin Williams' greatest strengths?
He does the best apology monologue.
Yeah. He does. Because he is a good subtle actor, genuinely.
Yeah, 100%.
He does too. His best,
for just being a piece of, like, just being a complete mess.
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah, Mrs. Doubtfire, Patch Adams, RV is probably the best apology monologue.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about RV. Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, and he's got him in this. He's got plenty in Flubber. So yeah, Flubber came out in 1997, right? So
he has like 8 apology monologues on this movie.
So
Robin Williams is either trying to convince everyone that he has invented the most life-changing thing ever, or he's apologizing. Those are the only 2 things he does in this movie.
So in the previous years, in 95, he had a supporting role in 9 Months with Hugh Grant, and then he was in Jumanji. 95,
Jumanji,
right?
Yeah.
Big family movie.
Yep.
96, he's in The Birdcage, which is, you know, more, it's a very funny movie.
That was a good movie.
I love The Birdcage. I also love the film that's based on, too. But yeah, he and Ethan Lane are so good in that, and Gene Hackman and everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a play and then a movie and then another movie, right?
Yeah. And then, but also in the same year, he's in Jack, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, the movie about the guy who ages quickly.
Yeah.
And then also in that same year has a small part in Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. And then in 1997, he has the triple threat of Father's Day with him and Billy Crystal, Good Will Hunting, and Flubber.
What?
So you have his Oscar-nominated role with Good Will Hunting and then Flubber the same year. And then I think post-Good Will Hunting, you kind of get him trying to do little more acting. So you have Patch Adams, which is sort of a combination of him doing his Robin Williams shtick, but it's also supposed to be a personal, like, true story about this guy. And then you have Bicentennial Man, which is also supposed to be more serious, like a drama. And then in 2002, you get him doing One Hour Photo and Insomnia, which are straight, like, dark performances. So this is kind of like the big... This is sort of the tail end of that family movie streak he had of, like, Jumanji and stuff like that. Yeah. That's
so weird.
So it could be very well say that, like, when he was doing this, he was just like, I'm on my way out. I'm done. I don't know if he had already done Good Will Hunting, but he was like, I'm going to get nominated for an Oscar. I don't need to... I don't need to do this again.
Well, the movie where he... I don't know if... Did we talk about it? And we might have started the podcast or it might have been before. We talked about the movie where he kills the childhood.
The clown.
He's like a clown, and then the other one is like a dinosaur. Okay. The movie's called Death to Smoochie, and it was made after this
one. I've heard of it.
Death to Smoochie was made after this one, directed by Danny DeVito. And it's Robin Williams is the guy who loses his show, and Edward Norton is Smoochie, the talking dinosaur. And then it has Jon Stewart in it, and Danny DeVito also stars and directs it. So it's, yeah.
The film was met with mixed negative reviews from critics and was a huge box office bomb, grossing only $8.3 million against a budget of $50 million. Despite this, in recent years, it has gained a cult following. I can see why. It sounds like a movie made for a cult following.
Yeah, 100%.
You know?
I'm surprised why Flubber didn't get it. It's probably because there's too much slapstick.
It's a movie for kids. Flubber made $93 million in the United States and $85 million in other countries for a total of $178 million. Was released on VHS and Laserdisc in 98.
Heck yeah.
I feel like this is a movie that probably did incredibly well on in terms of, like, its
DVD VHS
sales. Yeah, because I remember it specifically as an ad on VHS tapes that I had for other stuff. Huge hit. Surprised that it didn't lead to a Flubber franchise. Because, like, Flubber's also something you could make into a franchise.
You could make it two. You could change.
And you don't need Robin Williams.
You don't need Robin Williams. You could do anyone else.
Yeah. Like, you could do, you know, Son of the Mask? Like, Son of Flubber?
Exactly. You could have a Flubber movie where instead of...
Ride of Flubber.
Yeah, where instead of Flubber, you know, gets together two people who shouldn't be married, Flubber's found, like, a kid, and then keeps together two people that shouldn't be married. That should be the central tenet of Flubber. It's a piece of goo that is just getting people to nut in each other who probably shouldn't.
saves a kid from divorce.
From divorce, yeah, because there were so many of those movies.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, that was just like, oh, no, we gotta stop him from getting divorced.
Yeah. I'd also love to see if there was a 5 to 10 movie Flubber franchise, the diminishing returns of what comedic actor is going to star in each one. You know, like, you got Robin Williams in the first one of the greats. Next one,
Michael Cera.
I'm thinking, like, from the time period, the second would be like Charles Grodin.
Charles Grodin, because he was
also like Beethoven at the
time.
That
would be funny.
And then you get like Jamie Kennedy, you know, like just kind of like a little bit worse each time. Now we'd have one with, like, Lou Diamond Phillips or
it would be Josh Peck.
It probably should
be Josh Peck
doing his Josh
return to the big screen.
Him being like, oh, Flubber!
No, he's abandoned that.
Oh, that whole bit?
Have you seen... Yeah, well, he's trying to distance his personality away from
the Josh.
Yeah, the Josh Nichols personality.
I've seen some of his, like, TikTok and stuff. But, like, what personality does he have instead?
He wants to... He's, like, hyper-optimistic. It's like
That's gross.
It's like he's on... Yeah, it's terrible. It's legitimately the worst... It's the worst thing ever. Like, Drake, no. Bill, Drake Bill is getting charged by with child endangerment. No, yeah. Child endangerment. Child endangerment. And I like him more.
At least he didn't try to convince us he was something else.
No, I mean, I watched that whole, you know, just to clarify that joke. I watched the whole trial. Yeah, and he definitely did kind of like act irresponsibly and whatnot. But there were like 4 corroborating witnesses that said he was not engaging in like explicitly sexual content with this girl when she was, you know, like younger, right? He she would go to fan meetups, right? Yeah. And then she would allege that he met with her like alone, but like her friends testified against her and whatnot and stuff like that. But what he did do is like she would message him or whatever, and she would message him stuff that was like really kind of depressing, you know, like I don't, you know, nobody loves me, people are bullying me at school or whatever. And then he would be like encouraging, right? So he'd be like, no, you're so beautiful, which isn't appropriate to say to someone who's, you know, even if they're getting bullied or whatever, if you're, you know, 15, you can't say that to a 15-year-old girl, especially if you're a fucking, you know, if you're a fucking a famous person, right? Because that's going to develop some sort of unhealthy attachment, right? And then later when you come into the reality of like, oh, this can't happen, right? Then you have to be the one who's an adult now, and then they're not going to understand that.
Was there, and I think it's really important that this now turns into a Drake Bell podcast.
It is, yeah. It's a Drake Bell gossip podcast.
Yeah, you heard it here first. Drake Bell, justice for Drake. No, I'm kidding.
No.
But
I mean, he was convicted.
He was
acting irresponsibly. But
was there anything? Well, did she come of age and then there was a sexual relationship?
No, she wasn't. She didn't even. I don't even think she came of age. I mean,
before the trial.
When proceedings were started, I don't think she was of age.
Okay,
but
so it's ambiguous into whether or not somebody could nail him for like grooming, you know, like
I mean, you could see it as grooming, right? Yeah, what he did was super super irresponsible.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I wouldn't put him in the category of dangerous pedophiles.
Sure, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
But sure. I mean, also, you know, the guy spent his entire childhood playing someone who is just magnetically attractive to all 15-year-old girls, right? And then at some point, he was like, wait, I had to stop? What are you talking about?
Maybe I am.
I'm a teenage heartthrob.
That's my power. Well, now he's like, what, a sad 35-year-old guy and doesn't have that same effect on 35-year-old women.
No, he has a kid and he's huge in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
His apology video is in Spanish.
I saw that, yeah. Also, the last piece of canon Drake and Josh material is him playing Drake, but in Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
It's fascinating. I somebody could do a whole... Quentin Reviews, if everybody knows Quentin Reviews, he's done a breakdown.
Oh, he does like the 8-hour...
He did the iCarly video, and he did a Victorious video, and probably one day we'll end on a Drake and Josh video, but he's really done the deep dives on the canon of those, of the Schneiderverse. Dan Schneider, a horrible man.
Yeah, Dan Schneider, way worse than... Drake Bell.
Not to defend Drake Bell, but definitely Dan Schneider, a monster.
Well, Dan Schneider created the universe in which Drake Bell had to particularize himself in, right? Okay to make out with strange 15-year-old women, right?
Yeah.
Like that. He created that universe, and then there was a lot of TV that was like that. Like, I learned most of what it should be like to be a straight man from Barney Stinson and How I Met Your Mother, which is just Neil Patrick Harris's cartooned version of a straight man. Like, it's just a gay man's impression of a straight man. Is what I think I'm supposed to be doing.
A different woman every night. Like, yeah. That is hilarious. I never thought about that, that it's like, it's a gay man's interpretation of a straight man. That's so funny. Like, that's why he's such a caricature. Here I was the whole time thinking that's what I was supposed to be. That is, Barney Stinson is as accurate of a straight man as Mickey Rooney is an accurate Asian man in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Have you ever seen, this is such a weird segue. Yeah, have you ever seen, Japan does so much blackface.
Oh, yeah?
They do,
to this day?
They do it all the time, and you can watch it, and it's... It's the most head-scratching thing. You're like, is it racist? Did we nuke them into this?
Is it our fault? Maybe that was...
Do we need to nuke them again to stop it?
That's how you got liberals back on board.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. We switch everything up on them. We tell them, well, oh, the new terrorists are domestic terrorists and they're all rednecks. And then they're like, oh, let's crack down on terrorism. You know? And then that's the thing. What Japan's doing blackface. Oh, we gotta nuke them. That's how we get them. That's how we get the liberals on the pro-war side. Anyway. Yeah, I wish there was a greater, I think, political context to pull from Flubber that maybe you could somewhat pull from The Absent-Minded Professor. But really, I think it all comes down to We Were Horny.
Yeah, it's a Bill Clinton era movie, baby.
It's a Clinton era. Everything was going great.
We're horny, bro.
We're
stopping bullying. We're into drugs. We're horny. Nobody's mad at us. 9/11 happened. That's it. We went straight from anti-bullying documentaries in school. That's what I was watching when 9/11 happened. We ended bullying.
That's so funny. 9/11 happened.
Nobody's going to be mad. We're all going to get along. You flip the TV over.
Maybe we're focusing. Too much on bullying. Hey, and then
we stopped it here.
Right. And then after 9/11, we started bullying again, but just one group. Just one specific group.
Al Qaeda.
Yeah, Do you think that, part of it is the Clinton years, everyone thinks everything was just going great. You know, do you think that had some impact on the art we made where it's you know, 80s art was hyper consumerist, very flashy, very obviously there was this coping mechanism of taking advantage of the optimism of the Reagan years and kind of also going out of our way to ignore what was bad about it. Whereas the 90s, everyone was kind of under this impression everything's okay now. Is that why we get the sort of the bigger boom of us kind of experimenting again in the 90s, which we hadn't have done since the late 60s and 70s? Do you understand what I'm
saying? I kind of get what you're saying.
It was just, let's try anything. Flubber, fuck it. Let's, Flubber, sorry, I said Flubber, fuck it. Flubber, fuck it.
Yeah. I don't know. See, the thing is I don't know where where the film industry was kind of politically. Because, their goal is, I don't know, because, we've seen a lot of, I don't know, in the last couple with the whole Marvel releases, right, where they're just trying to expand to a global market, you know, because all the emerging markets as far as consumers are India, China.
Top Gun Maverick might have ended that.
Top Gun Maverick. Yeah, it had kind of a pretty anti-China slant to some extent, but you're still trying to expand to other places, right? Indonesia's one of the most populous, you know, places, and they're starting to get to where they can have consumers.
Yeah.
I think Africa is too, to some extent, but they have a bunch of problems, you know, so it's a question. But it's where do you even expand to in America or Europe, right? Because there aren't that many new people, you know, and there's already so much goddamn content that it's what do we need more?
Right.
Yeah. Right. At this point, it's have we reached the end of content yet? Are we just spiraling? And
I think here's what I'm going to think is going to come from Top Gun Maverick. Is we're ushering a new era of blockbuster movies going straight from middle America again, where because Top Gun Maverick got banned in China and was the biggest hit in many years. And so I think there's that feeling. Obviously, we're still going to get movies that, you know, do what they can to get the international releases that they want, but they kind of prove that we could still make an incredible amount of money and still not have the Chinese market. And that's obviously true. Like you said, there are other countries still.
With movies, I think it'll go to there, but I don't think other countries are at the same spot that we are with TV and TV shows.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Cause we have, we're advanced consumers where we have, whole days where we could spend 12 hours, you know, new Game of Thrones, new Lord of the Rings. New,
it amazes
me
all the shit that a person can watch.
Oh, yeah. The TV shows are, I think, where a lot of, and I think it's where a lot of, the really talented writers, directors, and actors are.
And that's where a lot of experimentations happen, too. And it makes sense because there's less to deal with. You're not paying for the distribution that you do with movies and, you know, filling movie theaters and the marketing that goes into it. It's much different.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of better superhero TV shows than I've seen superhero movies.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because it gives you more character, really in-depth character development than a movie can sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And also, there are little things, the sad reality is, when Black Panther was released in China, on the poster, he had his mask on. You know, like, you don't know that Black Panther is black. What is it? You know, every time Disney is like, oh, we're going to have our first gay couple in the movie, and it's like a background kiss or something that you don't really see or something.
Oh, yeah. They do that a lot. Yeah, something like that.
And so that happens every couple of years, and it's because they are genuinely worried. It's not just China, obviously, but it's just like they are worried about like that. They don't want to get banned in other places. Whereas like TV, we take a lot bigger chances because there's just a bigger, I don't know, I guess there's a better market for it. You feel more open to experimentation on the streaming platforms and stuff like that.
Yeah, that is true.
You know, and also,
and you can do like, because I mean, in film, in a lot of these like character driven films, it's going to be like you're going to have in-depth character development over across one or two arcs.
Yeah, right?
You know, it's very rare that you would see like a movie where there's, you know, character development across, you know, three or four characters, right? Because you can't normally fit that in one movie. Right. Yes. And even if you do, it's a big franchise like Lord of the Rings or something, right? Mm. But with a TV show, you can easily do that. You can have multiple story arcs, different people, you know, have their different developments, right? They're able to grow in their own kind of directions, right? And you, to some extent, you can't really, that's a limitation of film, right? And I think it kind of contributes to the way that people perceive themselves as individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Because you then particularly, like film teaches you, or all of these mediums, they teach you kind of what to desire, right? Yes. So a lot of your desires are based upon the desires that you have absorbed, you know, from film.
Yeah.
In that way.
Did you see the recent interview with, there was a clip that kind of went viral of Matt Damon was just on Hot Ones. And he was talking.
Yeah.
And he was talking about why they don't quite make movies like they used to. And one thing he pointed out was that in the 90s and 2000s, DVD was a huge part of the revenue stream. And then before that, it was like VHS or whatever mm-hmm. home video
yeah.
it was. And so you kind of counted that after your movie went out of theaters, you were still going to get a whole nother influx of revenue.
DVD sales.
DVD sales. Now you usually just sell to streaming and you don't get money per stream. You just you cut a deal with whatever streaming service it's mm-hmm. going to. And so you're really dependent. The biggest influx of money is whatever you're going to make in the box office. And so people take less chances for that reason, you know, where it's like they're kind of, you can kind of, the movies that do well on video are the movies that got good word of mouth, where maybe they went in and out of theater, but everyone was like, hey, you should watch this movie. And so people rented the video more. And that happens. There's so many stories about movies that we now consider classics that were not huge box office hits, but they did well afterwards on video. And that just, it's hard for that to happen now too. Where if your movie's not a box office hit, it's like you got to put it somewhere. And
that is true.
It goes somewhere and people will see it, but you're not going to get that, you know, that second wave of gross from
exactly. Yeah. You
know, wherever it goes.
Well, I mean, I guess the general, the general theory I have with like most artistic development, or even you can even take it to industrial development, right? And the parallel I would make is to like beer, right? So in like, you know, the 50s and 60s, right, brewing technology was really big, right? Mm-hmm. It was very big. Your kettles were huge, your burners were huge, right? And then so, you know, there was really just kind of Anheuser-Busch, right? They were king, right? You could have, you know, you have your Yingling, you have your Bud Light or whatever and whatnot. But then we were able to make with, you know, like you know, different innovations that we made in like engines and you know, boilers and whatnot, we were able to make brewing equipment smaller, right? And then that kind of let this craft beer sort of explosion happen, right? Where now you have like a bunch of different, and beer today is way better, right? Like craft beers are way better. There's so many people that have it, and I have the same kind of I think the same thing has been happening with just kind of media and content creation, right? The technology, like my phone, like, you know, the iPhone 13 or whatever, has an amazing camera on it. It records sound super well. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I can create content that is, you know, pretty good quality. And that has driven the, you know, like the, I guess the bar for content, the thing that I would click on up, you know? So I'm more able to recognize good content and create good content, which means that larger, you know, industries now have to adapt their business plan. Maybe they, you know, can't take more risks, but they definitely should be, you know? So now, you know, you're just kind of putting them in a bind to where, you know, they'll either, you know, they'll either innovate or they'll collapse. Right.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Most of them own some sort of digital real estate. So I think that's the business they're going into. They're like the Spotify's or the Amazon's, where they own a data center and then they manage the content, and then the content is produced to them, kind of in the way that Google runs YouTube.
Yeah.
And whatnot.
And, you know, until we kind of realize that risks are necessary, we'll never get experimentations like Flubber again.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, exactly. It's
kind of those shots in the dark.
Yeah, Flubber is a movie that they just could make because they were awash in cash. You know what I'm saying? Right. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't.
Let's do it.
Yeah. It's a remake, and they do that because they know that they'll at least get something. Yeah.
But they're not even like marketing it as a remake. It's got a different title.
No, they redid some stuff.
I pulled up some half star reviews from
Letterboxd
for Flubber. Some of them are kind of bonkers. I have watching this gave me the same feeling I had all those years ago. The same feeling that inspired me to carve Weebo into a pumpkin, then drop it and put the pieces on the doorstep for Halloween. When asked why, I had responded, because she's fucking dead, son. And that memory was more enjoyable to me than any part of this film.
What?
I've never seen a flying toaster with the D so badly as Weebo did.
Hate to see the relationship that guy has with his iPhone, dude. He probably comes on it and then doesn't wash it off.
Right. He just lets the film build up, you know, until it just no longer senses his finger.
Yeah, he's got a nut in phone.
Another person, half star, put this man in an institution. He can't remember shit and is a liability. This movie hates physics and has too many half-baked ideas all happening at once. It does hate physics.
The whole movie is he figured out how to break physics. That's the breakthrough.
Yeah. Must have been a damn good paycheck for Robin Williams to be in this shit. Yes, but also Robin Williams is no stranger to
he's getting paid.
Dumb
he was,
movies.
He was making movies.
Oh man, there's some long ones of people unlocking core memories. all right, I gotta find at least one mother. This is how bad this film is. At 10 years old, I walked out of this film and went, fuck this film. The full movie doesn't even have the part in the trailer where Flubber shakes its butt at the camera. Garbage. That's fair. That's fair. How could you give us that in the trailer and not fulfill it in the film? It feels like the natural extension of the Flubber dance.
Well, I remember a chief complaint. This was one of my dad's biggest complaints about these comedy movies, is he's like, the funniest parts were in the trailer.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember he would, so mad. I think he watched like a movie, it's like a Vince Vaughn movie. I think Vince Vaughn was the key to that, where Vince Vaughn would shoot enough funny riffs for a trailer, but not enough for an actual comedy movie.
Yeah, yeah. They should just make trailers.
Exactly, dude.
Like, why make a whole movie to go with it?
Bro, Vince Vaughn sucks. That's my hunch.
you don't like Vince Vaughn?
I don't like Vince Vaughn,
I like
bro.
Vince Vaughn a lot.
Oh, you do? I don't like him.
You gotta see... see like Braun Selbach 99.
Oh, okay.
I think that'll make you appreciate Vince Vaughn.
Okay.
But I do... I think this is kind of a case where at the time you also had movies like Snow Dogs or Kangaroo Jack.
Oh, dude, Kangaroo Jack.
Which were... But here's the thing about Snow Dogs and Kangaroo Jack is they're movies that are mostly about like people. They're mostly about Snow Dogs is about Cuba Gooding Jr., but the trailer capitalized on the sequence where he dreams about the dogs talking.
100%.
You know? Where it's like, or whatever, where it's just like, that's what we need. We need our crazy, our kid-friendly thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, this is mostly a movie about Robin Williams trying to stop Christopher McDonald from taking his girlfriend, but the trailer played up like, there's Flubber, it's this goofy thing that's going to shake his butt and dance, you know?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you also had Kangaroo Jack, which is a movie about Anthony Anderson in the sky and like money and
crime.
It's
a drug operation, and they played the trailer was the two times that kangaroo talked.
Yeah,
they only did it twice
in dream sequences.
In dream sequences.
Where the kangaroo raps like the kangaroo raps like a hip a hop to the hip, but like in a Australian accent, and that was the movie to so many people was that sequence, and they watched it and they're like, what the hell is this? This isn't the kids' movie.
This is it. Yeah, this is
like
kangaroo movie.
Right. So I think this also can kind of be thrown in with that phenomenon of like taking a movie that was supposed to be about people, and like kind of finding that one gimmick we're going to market it.
Yeah, the marketing department did not talk with the film at all. They didn't even see it. It was
yeah, they're like, you had Flubber do what in the trailer? Flubber shaked its butt in the trailer?
It was that scene from Mad Men where they're describing cigarettes and whatnot. Yeah. Like, they're not good for you anymore. They're just they're just refreshing or something. Like, they market it as something completely different than what it is.
Is there anything else you want to say about Flubber?
Nah, I'm good, man. I think we
exhausted.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted it and some other stuff.
I think this is the most well-rounded documentation on Flubber probably ever known.
That's the most one-star review. It didn't even get a full podcast about
Trello. For the record, I gave this 2.5 stars on Letterboxd. I gave it straight down the middle. That's dope. Like, there's enough that I kind of appreciate about it.
I liked it when I was a kid. I don't like it now.
You don't like it? Nah. Yeah, yeah. Well, you've outgrown it. You've got her now.
I've got her.
Yeah. All right. Cool. We'll do this again sometime.
That'd be dope. Fun. Yeah, it was a fun one.
Maybe we actually will do all the Twilights, you know?
That'd be cool. Yeah. I mean,
I'd love to have an excuse to go see them.
Dude, they're fun, dude. Yeah. They are. They're fun. I mean, I'll say this about them. It'll be a teaser for the Twilight episode. It's, you know, they're like super Mormon, right?
The writer?
Yeah. The story.
Well, yeah, I know, because there's like they wait until marriage for sex and stuff like that.
Not even that, right? So the Book of Mormon talks about like the ancient people, like the Nephites or whatever, mm-hmm. right? They're the group of Jews that, you know, sailed over to America and whatnot. And then they come into contact with the Lamanites, which are the Native Americans of the time. And then they interact with like the, you know, the savage people and whatnot. And then Jesus, after he dies, comes down in, you know, like... in like, you know, the holy place or whatever, right, in the Gospels, but then he comes down everywhere else too, right? Mm-hmm. So the Book of Mormon is telling the story of the Nephites and the Lamanites and how you know, the spirit descends upon them kind of as well, right? And so in that, the Twilight movies are about, you know, these vampires who are, you know, they're hundreds of years old, right? They're the ancient people, but they're new to this land, right? They mm-hmm. come into contact with the werewolves, the Lamanite metaphor, and then the big bad is the a different sect of vampires that is running everything from Italy, right? And then their vampire superpower is largely like guilt-based. It just makes you feel bad for all the stuff that you've ever done. Yeah, is one of them. And I'm like, oh, that's the most Catholic metaphor I've ever seen in my entire life.
Right.
So it's very, I don't know if Stephanie Meyer did it intentionally. I haven't watched an interview with her. I think I watched like the Oprah interview with her, but you could tell that it's kind of like a story that's like shaped her life.
Yeah.
You know, so she just sort of, and she said it came to her in a dream, right? So, you know, maybe she's, you know, been so involved in Mormonism that, you know, it just naturally bled into sort of the discourse of Twilight.
It's one of those things, like, even if you don't have an agenda, your identity is always going to play into the art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the stories that you tell are going to be
exactly. All right, cool. Well, I can't wait. Sweet. We'll do it.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
All right, everybody, that wraps up yet another episode of We Are Movies. Thank you so much for listening. Huge thank you to my friend Jordan for coming on. Really appreciate it, as always. If you haven't yet, you can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at We Are Movies Pod, so you never miss an episode. You can also like the Facebook page, We Are Movies. And if you want to, you can follow me on my comedy Instagram or TikTok, Johnny Mockney Comedy. Feel free to do that. And that is all I have for you this week. I'll be back with you very soon, another 2 weeks from now. I'm trying to go by a bi-weekly schedule these days as life gets busier, so every other Sunday is when you can expect a new episode. Until then, this is Johnny Mockney saying that I hope you have a very flaborious Labor Day weekend. Bye-bye.